So I think the last couple times I was here, or the last classes I gave, one was on lust and one was on anger. And so tonight I want to continue that look at various emotions. And so tonight I'd like to talk about pleasure. That's I must distinguish it from lust, because I don't think lust is a particularly pleasant experience, although satisfaction of lust is. But lust itself, that kind of driving desire, is fairly unpleasant. And of course, anger and ill will are unpleasant. So I talked last time about them from first the Abhidhamma and then the middle way point of view. So tonight, as I said, I'd like to talk about pleasure, because I think pleasure is just as confusing for us as some of these others, more negative or difficult emotions. And pleasure is difficult in a different way. So I think that one reason it's difficult is it's definitely a hindrance to practice. But if you don't have some pleasure and a certain kind of pleasure in your practice, it makes it very hard to continue it for years. So I'd like to talk a little bit about that. A student remarked to me one evening that her practice was going very well. She had been able to sit consistently and in a disciplined way for some time, over a year. And she had been able to resolve a disagreement with another Sangha member in the best possible way. And she had actually gone from her frantic, crazed approach to work to a much calmer and more compassionate point of view, and people had actually noticed. So she was much praised as a central person in her office. So that was very good. So she told me that things were going very well. She was feeling a sense of accomplishment in her practice. Then the very next day she sent me an email saying, "Well, I was feeling high about practice and Sangha, etc., but of course life keeps going. This morning I got an email from a friend who is very upset with me, and I had a fight with my husband before work. So I have more feelings to feel and to work with. Yikes!" I love her little yikes. "So that's too bad that she had such a brief period of calm and peace," of course. "But this is such an ordinary experience," she describes, "isn't it? We just can't resist keeping score of our ups and our downs and drawing conclusions from them. We have some ongoing sense over the years of progress toward happiness. We're just almost to the other shore, almost. We can smell it, we can almost feel it, almost, and then something bad happens, and we've lost ground. We're pulled away. That's how we often see these events. And then a man who has had severe back pain for some time, and has spent the last couple of years on disability, and in bed most of that time, going from a very highly functional person in the computer business to flat on his back for some time. He called me to tell me that he had felt so good this winter compared that he'd actually gone on a ski weekend. So I was marveling over that, but then he continued by telling me that a week later he had been flat on his back again, just like years before. And when he woke up that first morning and the pain was back, he was so depressed that he couldn't even get out of bed. And I said, "Well, I guess you got attached to feeling good." And he said, "No kidding." No kidding. So I said, is it possible for you to just go skiing when you go skiing and just lie in bed when you lie in bed and not carry each one around with you in between? So he reset himself for the present moment, as opposed to weeks and months. He reset himself for, how do I feel now? Blinked open at the beginning of the day. How do I feel now? That's the only time that matters. So, let's see, how long should I make this? Okay. So, let's skip that. So we're always going to have to make that reality adjustment when we discover that we've been sucked in by our good fortune. When we get attached to things working well. These students' accounts are just ordinary examples of how we get attached in an ordinary way to ordinary pleasant states of mind. Not even extraordinary rapture states of mind, but just ordinary relief of pain or just a pleasant state of mind. Sometimes we even, and this is the worst, we even confuse things going well with our practice, with the fruits of our practice. Actually, the fruits of practice are way beyond things going well. So when we coincide the two, when we think things going well is due to our good practice, we're selling short our practice and we're also going on hiatus. We're just kind of cruising. We think that since things are going well, I must be doing something right. What am I doing right? I'm sitting zazen. This is very unfortunate. Coincidence to equate sitting meditation with things going well. So is there any harm in thinking this way then? Well, it just depends on your point of view. How often do you want to adjust your reality? Every day, every week, every month? How often do you want to realign yourself with reality because you've been away from it for so long? And how much do you want to invest in your delusions of reassurance? So if we get attached to any state of mind and we suffer when that state of mind changes, then it's like we fall into a pit and we can't get out. And as a matter of fact, feeling self-satisfied or feeling blissful may be a very difficult state of mind to practice with. You may not be able to practice with bliss at all. Because for most of us, unless you have been sitting for a long time and developed a great deal of stability, bliss isn't too intoxicating. It sweeps you away. In fact, I often see Rinzai Zen, which pushes toward a Kensho experience. That's how you start your practice in Rinzai Zen, with a Satori kind of experience that they call Kensho. And then the next 30 years is to ground that experience, to ground it. So the hermit of Lotus Peak held forth his staff before his assembly and asked, when the ancient ones reached this, why didn't they stay there? The assembly was silent. Answering for his listeners, he said, because it has no power for guidance. He was asking, why don't the ancient ones just stay in the beautiful peace of complete, all-pervading bliss for the rest of their lives? Why don't they do this? Why did Buddha bother to get up from under the Bodhi tree and teach? What a drag to get up and talk to stubborn, opinionated people all the time. But he did it. Why did Bodhidharma come from the West? Because it has no power for guidance. So even though bliss can be distracting, it's still very encouraging for us to have pleasure in our lives and in our practice. Very few of us could continue to be helpful and generous people if we were just looking at the oblique life full of sorrow and loss. Very few of us could continue to be generous and helpful to other people. So what is the difference then between chasing pleasure and happiness and the pleasure that makes our miserable lives bearable and even useful? So what kind of pleasure is conducive to practice? Well, part of the general problem with pleasure and chasing happiness is that even though we're all very intent on our profit and our happiness, we get confused about what it actually looks like. So if we define our happiness very specifically, this will make me happy, or this state of mind or this possession will make me happy, then we identify it very specifically, and especially if we identify it outside ourselves, a state of mind that we don't happen to come by ordinarily, or we crave objects that offer us security or pleasure, prestige, or even entertainment, we make ourselves very vulnerable to suffer, either from not being able to get a hold of these things, these possessions or these states of mind in the first place, or once we have them, not being able to keep them. This is what people often experience in sashins, long sitting. They get into states of mind that they love, and poof, they're gone. Or we simply have no idea what would make us happy. For instance, when I first started sitting, I started sitting because I wanted peace of mind and happiness. I wanted to be able to control my mind and not get into these angry, depressive states that I was prone to. So of course I projected this desire onto my practice and said, is it here yet? Is it here yet? Are the fruits of practice here yet? But of course the mind that does that, that projects into the future, has no accessibility to the real fruits of practice. Just not a clue how wide and vast those fruits are. So this is not the mind that enjoys those fruits when they gradually come along. Or it's not even the mind that can recognize the fruits. So this is a big problem if we define our happiness and the fruits of practice too narrowly. As long as things outside ourselves are what we're looking for, things outside ourselves are what we will find. But since these things are not ultimately what we're looking for, our searching is a chase after a phantom. A student asked Matsu, "What is essential in Buddhism?" Matsu said, "Just that you let go of yourself and your life." In other words, these are my words, in other words, you have to dramatically expand your conception of what your life should be. Dramatically expand. What's your conception of what your life is about? And Jungmann later commented on this exchange between the student and Matsu. He said, as long as you don't let go, you're nothing but a wild fox ghost. And this is the same ghost referred to in The Gateless Gate, the Mumon Khan, the collection of koans that Rinzai students go through. He or she who does not cut off the mind road is a ghost clinging to bushes and grasses. You're just a ghost clinging to the insubstantial, when you hold on to your ideas about happiness, when they're not grounded in your life, your reality, then you're just holding on to insubstantial things. So the worst thing, though, about getting attached to certain ideas about happiness or particular states of mind that you already have is that any attempt to hold on to a state of mind interferes with immediate experience, with the experience you're actually having now, which actually is sometimes a motivation for us to hold on to certain states of mind. We don't want this experience right in front of us. And when you do prefer a certain state of mind over another, whether it's pleasure or pain, you lose your capacity to be present in the moment. You're constantly living somewhere else, in the past or in the future, hankering for some situation that you've known or that you hope to know, striving for in the future. But our actual situation in life is that of the monk who was being chased by a tiger, and he jumped over a cliff to escape the tiger and hung on to some branches that were growing out of the cliff there. And he thought, well, he just jumped down to the land below, but he looked down and there's another tiger below him. So tiger above, tiger below. What can he do? And then he just happened to notice a ripe strawberry that was growing out of a plant by the branches he was holding on to. No strawberry ever tasted so delicious. So this is what our actual life is. Caught between two tigers. It behooves us to be able to appreciate and enjoy the pleasure that offers itself to us. And then just go on to the next thing, whether it's dying or going to work or whatever it is. And to learn to cultivate the strawberries in our lives. Those strawberries are always popping up in our lives. So we need to cultivate the consciousness that notices the strawberries, that connects deeply with the experience that we're having right now. And this is what we really want. Isn't this what we really want? The ability to connect up with whatever our life actually is. This is what we're looking for in all the wrong places. This ability to connect up with, whether it's good or bad, the ability to connect up with it is what we want. Yinman said during a Dharma talk to his students, he said, I don't ask you about before the 15th day. Try to say something about after the 15th day. Since nobody said anything, Yinman answered for everyone. He said, every day is a good day. So what does that mean, every day is a good day? Is that denial of suffering? Is that putting a happy face on things? I don't think so. First of all, I don't think he was talking about the specific date as such, the 15th of the month. Although I think he referred to that date, the 15th, just to bring in the relative world. Dates is one way we break up reality. So I think he mentioned it just to include the relative mundane world in which we, like, face. On a calendar, we assign days, dates to days, completely arbitrary. What I think he probably wanted, though, from his students was a statement about what is your experience now? How are you doing right now? So not only is this after the 15th day, but what is your present experience? Something that refers to how vast and wide our world is when we give something our absolute attention. Of course, this is all vast and wide. The world is all vast and wide. But the particulars, if you focus on something, the particulars also are vast and wide. Anything you give your total attention to is your whole world, vast and wide and deep. So basically, every day is a good day is about the basic goodness, the basic connection, when you're able to connect with the things of your life intimately. Then every day is a good day because you're connected up with it, whatever it is, suffering, pain, delusion. Is being connected up with your delusion, is that delusion? I don't know. So, after a few years of practice, like 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 years of practice, people get, you know, it gets stale. You know, you're doing the same sort of practice day in and day out. For most people, they've started, you know, established a sitting practice, a regular sitting practice, and they do this practice. They go to Sangha, they take a class or two, maybe part of a Dharma group, but there's still some yearning, some staleness about practice. And this is often when people leave practice because they don't understand how to deepen their practice. Well, there are many ways to deepen practice. You can study with a teacher, study sutras or koans with a teacher. You can study the precepts, take the precepts in a formal ceremony. You can join a Dharma group of other people and study together. But all these ways of deepening your practice have the same thing in common, which is to increase your connection, your intimacy with things, with your life specifically, with the details of your life. So that's the direction of all those possibilities, the precepts, the sutras, the koans with a teacher, all of that is to increase your ability to be immediate. Because what does that immediacy do? It soaks up our restlessness. It soaks up our yearning. That immediacy with things soaks up that stuff that makes us run around. So how should we set up our lives and to promote this kind of intimacy? Well, I think the simpler our lives are, the better. And I don't mean simple in terms of the various realms that we course in, like how complicated our jobs are, how complicated our social relationships are, or our other relationships. I mean simple in terms of always knowing what the fundamentals are. Basically, we were born, we're living and breathing, and we're going to die. That's it. If you can keep that always in view, you won't go too far afield. It gives you tremendous freedom to know that that's the basic fact of your life. You can decide what's the most important thing to you in your life and go about doing it. No effort, then, on the part of our culture to turn you into a super consumer or a super producer will work. You just won't be seduced. Because your standard for encounters with other people will not admit of just a brush-off kind of relationship, even with a sales clerk. Even with people on the street, you will demand intimacy and connection from all your relationships, no matter how brief. And you will demand of the effort you make that it's very intimate, that it's very connected up. and a job, a super producer job, that doesn't allow you that connection will not interest you. So the ability of the culture to bend you to its current will not succeed. Simplicity allows us to experience our minds in a more direct and straightforward state. When we can appreciate life on the level of living from our body's point of view, or noticing the raw data of our senses and our emotional experiences, then everything right here is very interesting and compelling. We aren't as likely to run around looking for something else. Then pleasure is not something that shows up in our lives randomly or after a frantic and exhausting pursuit. It's the river running through everything. Yunnan's every day is a good day. Meditation creates a person whose happiness is not dependent on circumstances. A person able to focus on whatever is in front of them. For instance, a person in a lot of pain or a lot of mental anguish, distress, crisis, whatever, their mate has just been diagnosed with cancer, their child is in trouble. A person undergoing that kind of mental distress, or a person in a lot of physical pain, chronic pain and won't go away, has to find some way to make their lives a support, a sustaining support. They have to find solace in their life somewhere. And on a fairly, depending on the amount of anguish, on a fairly consistent basis. If they're in crisis, they have to look for the anguish. I mean, their anguish causes them to look for solace. So I think, for instance, if you can cultivate the mind of intimacy, that finding solace and pleasure in our mundane objects is one way to go. For instance, chairs, eating utensils, our tools, our bed clothes, our beds. We have the most fabulous beds. I mean, the bed technology is at its peak. We have very hard support beds, you know, to support your back, and then we have that egg carton stuff that makes it all soft while it's hard. I mean, just the best. And we have all kinds of different kinds of pillows. We have very pretty quilts that imitate the old-fashioned quilts. We have chairs, you know, that are art objects. You know, do you know the Museum of Modern Art catalog, the MoMA catalog? Mundane objects that are so beautiful that they have been given awards, like tea kettles and staplers, and knives, and clocks. So beautiful, and yet so useful. There's tremendous solace in objects like this, or just your spoon and fork. All these things have been made for human beings. They've been formed for human beings. They fit your mouth. They fit our skeletons. There's tremendous solace in our mundane objects because of this. So if you can appreciate a spoon and see its spoonness and its relationship to you, it's very comforting. This was made just for me. Very comforting. And plates, well, washing the dishes is like going to the art gallery. You know, I mean, if you're a shut-in and that's the extent of it. This is very comforting, all these things. You put food on the plate, and when you wash it, it becomes all clean. So you have to be connected to appreciate such pleasures. You have to be intimately connected up with your activity and the objects that you touch. I'm not a carpenter, but sometimes when I've held carpenter's tools, I've been very moved. A hammer is so heavy that it almost can substitute for strength, you know, just by its very weight, hitting a nail, putting a nail in, hit the curve of it, the wood of it. And then there are lots of tools, I don't even know what they are, but they look very efficient. So I admire the carpenter, and I know a couple of them that use these tools as if they were extensions of their own body, as opposed to commanding or possessing the tools. The tool is almost like an extension, not in a power way particularly, although I imagine it would make you feel that way. But there's a respect for the tools. So Suzuki Roshi said, although seeing a large golden Buddha is easier, when you see a large Buddha in a blade of grass, your joy will be something special. It isn't what we possess or have commanded, it's what we notice. How we find the sustenance for our lives in our everyday, mundane, workaday world. And I also think, again, with finding the strawberries, cultivating the mind that notices the strawberries, I think part of that is a conscious intention toward all the things of our lives, toward our zafus and zabatan, all these objects that help us do what we want to do. I think it's our conscious intention toward including them or using them or being aware of them when we use them. Don't count your breath just to avoid your thinking mind. Take the best. Conscious intention to take care. Again, Suzuki Roshi. And take care of your forks. And take care of your microwave. That's me. So Buddhism has a reputation for pessimism due to a misinterpretation of the First Noble Truth, seeing it as a philosophical statement rather than as a practical entryway into practice. But actually, Buddhism considers a joyful, open, generous state of mind a natural state of mind. Natural, harmonious, and wholesome expression of our true nature. Buddhism is extremely optimistic about human nature, more than Western psychology is. According to the Abhidhamma, which you've heard me speak of, which is the oldest practice document that we have, after you have learned through meditation to temper your greed, hate, and delusion, what naturally arises, since you've gotten some things out of the way, is this very harmonious, joyful state of mind. And it's the joy in that stage of practice that actually enables you to go further, that actually encourages you to practice other more advanced practices. After you take care of just the gross forms of hatred and terror, after you just temper those a little bit, then some sort of joy naturally arises. And this is a help in your practice. It's an attitude, a kind of spaciousness. And this is very encouraging to practice. You actually need this sort of feeling before you can do harder things. Before you have the stability. This joy gives you the stability to be able to look at you, for instance, look at yourself more objectively. It's very hard to look at yourself. We always flinch away. We can't stand it. But if you have some stability from your meditation practice, then you can look straight on at yourself. Oh yes, I tend to do this. Oh yes, I tend to do that. And you don't just run screaming into the wilderness and never look at yourself again. So you need this kind of grounding, of stability. So ironically, studying our suffering via the Four Noble Truths does not make pessimists of us. It shows us the source of our misery and how distorted views make it impossible for us to appreciate the many blessings that we actually have. These anguished states of mind or fear, hatred, or a habit of negative judgment distort our view, make us unable to realize just a roof over our heads is pretty good. So the solution to all this is just to live your life. The just means living your whole life. It's just being alive for all the details of your life, not deciding which you're going to avoid and which you're going to be present for. You can take care of your body simply because it yearns to be taken care of, and you're alive. You're listening to its yearnings, the flowing in and out of its intelligence, not making it into a separate being from yourself. You can attend to your relationships with a heart that's open to everyone's various characteristics, pleasant and annoying, both. Those you enjoy, those you don't enjoy. In this way, there's an absence of struggle. It's not you against the circumstances of your life. It's your being there with the circumstances of your life. You do your best for your body and your relationships. That's your best, not the perfect thing. I was discussing with someone today how many of these koans that we read have the teacher threatening to do something drastic, like if somebody says something, they can keep me from cutting this cat in half. Nonsense. Nobody said anything. Nobody said anything because they thought they should say something profound. And nonsense. Went back to his cabin, so depressed, so upset. He said to his friend Joshi what had happened, and they both went in mourning. So we don't have to say or do the absolute perfect thing in any situation. We just do what we do. I personally think somebody shouting out, "Don't!" would have probably satisfied. So if you do see your cycle of craving and aversion and regard it with some humor or detachment, be amused at the fact that you're always running after something or running away from something, then you can begin to practice the disinterested pursuit of pleasure. The disinterested pursuit of pleasure. And this is pleasure recognized and fostered rather than chased after. And grasp that. You can cultivate pleasure in the same way that you eat sensibly or put on your jacket when it's cold. This is just something you do for your own and other people's sake. So from a practice point of view, the state of mind of equanimity or joy is not the preferred state of mind any more than emotional upheaval or agitated bliss, or temper tantrums or being depressed. It's just another state of mind. one of the thousands that pass through us every day. In fact, that's part of what we learn from our meditation, just how many thoughts, how many states of mind, how many whatever pass through us while we're just watching. So I think our practice as Zen practitioners is to welcome them all equally, compassionately, and follow them to the source. So are there any questions or comments on pleasure or anything else? Miriam?
You just the last thing you said, and follow them to the source.
Well, do you mean the cause of the feelings? I meant more the source of it in your own mind. Kind of like clouds coming up in a blue sky kind of thing. You know, if you sit still, you see some blue sky and then the clouds come up and come up and come up. And yet, every time something comes up and passes away, then you see that it, you could get a glimpse of blue sky. It's true other things fall quick on the heels, but still, so it's like distinguishing between the movie and the screen. If you go to the movies, most of us just get caught up in the movie that's being projected on the screen. But every once in a while, if you look at the screen, you feel like you're God or something. You see that at the source. Right.
Can you say again what the response was to the question of why didn't the ancient ones remain in the bliss states?
Because it has no power for guidance. Just the fact that if people are happy, you can't do much with them. Yes.
What do you mean by you said connect us? What does us mean?
Oh, I'm just continuing the word connect. It doesn't mean anything particular. Do you want to know what connect means? Or do you think you have a handle on that?
Well, I think I know, but I'd like to hear it again. I mean, I'd like to.
It's
probably English. Yes, I would like to.
Well, I think it's the ability to focus your attention. On a particular thing. We have, now I think, actually, I can get into this a little bit. Actually, I think mental flexibility is really the most important thing. Because not only do you need to be able to focus your attention here, then move over and focus it here, move over and focus it here. I think you've done that exercise with me in which we have, do walking meditation, we have various objects of focus. So on a dime, you have to change your objects of meditation and sink deeply into that, then come out of that and sink deeply into this. Come out of that and sink deeply into that. That's what we have to do in our work all day, basically. So the flexibility that you bring to that ability determines, actually, on those transitions, if there's a lot of struggle, there's a lot of energy lost. As an example, here you are, you know, doing your work in the phone room. So if you have trouble arising out of your task, turning and sinking deeply into the phone, that's a big problem for most people's jobs. And then after the phone call, sinking into this again. Or multitasking really asks you to be mentally flexible. The reason, I think I've told this group before, the reason that we experience multitasking as uncomfortable or unsatisfying is we're usually focused on what we're not doing. instead of what we are doing. We kind of put this on automatic pilot and then we think of what has to be done. But you can multitask if you drop briefly, rise up, drop briefly, rise up, and just keep it moving quickly. It's much more satisfying. So that's one thing to be able to do, is rise up out of a deep connection and move over. There's another kind of focus which is also important, which is to go from wide, vast and wide, to particular, vast and wide. Wide, vast and wide, the whole picture, you're the, you know, the supervisor, and there's 10 people that you're supervising, so you have to be vast and wide. You have to have an idea of the project and who should do what and blah, blah. And then you know, after everybody's job is assigned, you do your coordinating of bringing it together, which is more focused than that vast and wide job assignment. So you have to move, or even you're cooking a meal, you have to do that. If there are 3 dishes, you want them all to come out at the same time. You've got to sink deeply into prep, open up to make sure this next thing is prepared and cooking in time to be done at the same time. You get my drift. So where we lose energy and get into trouble is we get attached to stuff that keeps us from moving smoothly, from wide to particular, from deep, move over, deep, move over, deep. We get attached to stuff in there, and then we're caught in a struggle. We aren't willing to move on for whatever reason. We like this job better than this one or whatever. But actually, if you see your work day as just a river that you're dipping your hands into, then you just go easily from thing to thing. And then when you go to bed at night, you just pull your hands out of the river and go to sleep. There's no energy lost in those transitions. You just see everything as activity. It's like a river. So thank you for asking that question. It gave me a chance to talk about that. That's very interesting to me. I have another book coming out next month, and that's what it's about. Working. Anything else? Yes.
When you're skiing, you're supposed to be skiing. And when you're on your back, you're supposed to be on your back. But wonder if your kids want you to be skiing, and your partner wants you to be skiing, and the world wants you to be skiing. But, you know, you think like you need to be on your back.
Then you're very lonely.
So it's a hard place to be.
I think it's very lonely for people in this culture to have to value the experiences of their lives more than they value things. I think it's very hard right now to value intangibles. So that's why we come together in a group like this of like-minded people. Now I think in the skill realm, once you've accepted being lonely, there are skillful things you can do to bring your wife and children around to a companionable point of view. You know, it's just skill. After you've made the settlement, the settling into whatever you are, then it's just a matter of skill. Well, for instance, me, I don't walk very fast, but I love to hike. And I love to do it with other people. So if I do it with everyone I know, it's a drag for them. So what I do is we go and we have a lunch that they carry. And then they just go do their hiking. They go away from me because, you know, people have to go at their own pace, and to do it as slowly as I do is painful to most people. So they go do it, and then they come back to me, and then they go do the same thing again and come back to me, and then we stop and have lunch, then they go off and come back to me, kind of like a dog does. a dog can go a lot faster than a human. So they run around and sniff around and they come back to you. Run around, sniff around, and come back. So usually if you're the person left out, you're the most creative. The illness is on you. Usually. Is that answering your question?
Well, I get caught up with the notion of consistency. About some days I can ski and some days I can't, but and people will expect that. It's like if you're going on a hike, darling, people will expect that you're going to walk slowly, so they're prepared for that. Mm-hmm. But wondering if we all sit here tonight and you're just in up, you're flat, you feel thick as a brick, and we're all sitting here looking at you, and we're expecting you to be consistent, we're expecting you to be, you know, profound, we're expecting the same Darlene who showed up last time she was here, but you're just like, flat.
Sorry. I love it. Well, you know, I'm not impressed with consistency. I'm sorry. It's just one of those things that just doesn't matter so much to me. And I did get some support years ago when I came across Jung's quotation, consistency is the mark of mediocrity. So I think that if you have ongoing relationships, especially the ones you mentioned, between children and a mate, I mean, friends can, you know, be toward the acquaintance end or toward the real soulmate end, you know, and everything in between. But to keep a mate relationship alive, you really have to go moment to moment. All the way to looking at their face like nobody, you have never met this person before. I mean, you have to constantly reassert the beginner's mind with a mate, or it'll just be only consistency, only mechanical logistics. You pick up the kid, yeah. You know, I think logistics, this is my own thing, I think logistics destroy marriages. If people only stay in the logistical realm, especially when they have small children, you know, that's all it is for a couple of years is logistics. But if you stay there, I think it really destroys a relationship. So I think you have to make a great effort to keep in touch with yourself and convey and communicate that to the other person. And if you've been lucky, you'll have a person that values that. If you've not been so lucky, then you have to be skillful. Yes.
So there's this great discrepancy between joy and sorrow, and how to find a way where you're experiencing both of them. And it's just very disorienting. I wonder if you could say something about how to look at practice during time like that.
Well, from a practice point of view, there's not so much difference between joy and sorrow. From a practice point of view, there's feelings, emotions that you have that pass through you stronger at one moment, weaker than another. And because emotions are so fluid, it really doesn't bother your body to be host to them all in rapid succession. In fact, as we all know, they're quite related, joy and sorrow. They turn into each other, you know, with some regularity, based on the same sort of thing. So I think that in your situation, I would really try, like the skier, to ski when he skis and be in bed when he hurts. So when you are with her father, or think of her father, then there might be some feeling that goes with that. And then, but actually, to open yourself to all the range of those feelings is to have a pretty rich, full life. They don't contradict each other at all. They're all together. So I personally come down on the roller coaster side of life. I think that that, to me, rich and full. And I would never want to crawl up to the hub of the wheel and just have nothing. Just be calm all the time. So if you're on the edge of the wheel, sometimes you're on top, looking all around, looks great from up here, and then the wheel turns and you're ground underneath. Oh, terrible down here. Then go back up. Oh, it's wonderful up here. So if you can see that this is what happens in life, it can be very rich. So to have both these events happening at the same time, that's
my daughter, trying to help her to understand that there's a way to walk through a time like this.
Is she feeling badly that she's having her wedding at this time?
I think her friend got really upset, and trying to help her find a path to know that both
Well, does she want to postpone her wedding?
That's great joy. Her death is great sorrow. So, I mean, I've experienced the circumstances, but she's 24 and a half, and I'm just trying to help her negotiate
through this. Well, that's certainly your job if she decides to go ahead with her wedding. She might feel better to postpone it, to kind of honor the feeling that she has. One more question. Thank you very much.